Well, one of the most interesting things to me was once we understood how the performance markers in the tests were supposed to go. After heavy training, the numbers would normally go down. After the lighter training in the early parts of the blocks, those performance numbers in the tests would go up so that they were recovered and adapted to what they'd done before and ready for heavier training going forward.
Hi, Derek. It's my pleasure to have you on Evidence Strong Show. If you could briefly introduce yourself.
Dr. Derek Wilcox. I've got a PhD from East Tennessee State University in sport physiology and performance. My master's degree was in sport kinesiology from the same program. And now I am a coach for Renaissance Periodization and do sport science consulting.
That sounds awesome. So I invited you today because you have written a thesis that was titled The Training of a Para Powerlifter, a case study of adaptive monitoring, training, and overcoming. So the thesis, PhD thesis in weightlifting or powerlifting or any strength sports is very, very rare. And you did your study in para powerlifting, which is, I don't know, a few thesis a year, I would say. So super, super rare topic. So I wanted to ask you first why, how the thesis came about.
Sure. I got involved with para athletics, with disabled athletes in general, and I started realizing that regardless of how well-meaning a lot of the people that were running these events and the coaches were, most of them were on a volunteer basis. And it's getting to the point where the Paralympics are actually super high-level competitions. And the feats of strength that they have going on in para-powerlifting at the international level are unbelievable. Some of the most impressive things I've ever seen in strength sports in general. And it dawned on me, being around these competitions, that injuries and, of course, the ability to train an athlete for performance, but the injuries would drastically change the quality of life of the athlete. If you've got someone isolated to a wheelchair or who is dependent on walking with their arms in some shape or fashion, then a shoulder injury is not just an inconvenience for them. It's not something that they have to walk around in a sling for and let it rehab and take care of it. They can't hardly move. They're basically stuck where they are unless they have help. So understanding that, and of course, having the drive for excellence in sport performance, to combine those two aspects, they're very much married together, health and performance. And I wanted to at least take a stab at trying to get good information out of some kind of methodology to help protect those athletes.
Awesome. So let's go straight into your goals. So what were the goals of your project?
The goals were to try and help establish some form of athlete monitoring for disabled athletes. Most athlete monitoring practices are involved heavily in lower body movements, whether it's squats, jumps, anything on a force plate, standing, isometric mid-thigh pulls, all those kinds of things. They're heavily biased towards the lower body. So when you have an entire population of athletes who are the opposite, they are biased towards the upper body, then that's not going to work out too well. And those athletes need reliable and valid monitoring methods to help protect them from injury and, of course, track their progress in training and things like that. So we came up with the idea of using GRIP, which was already kind of established in literature, especially from the Soviet weightlifting programs back in the 70s and 80s. They use those kind of tests. They have their downfalls and their benefit, just like anything else. But GRIP testing was a really good idea to try and monitor more neural fatigue. Since the hands are so highly innervated, we get a better idea of central fatigue from the GRIP. And then the other method was using bench press velocity, your standardized test. Well, in the study, we used 100 kilos for sets of three. I believe it was sets of three. And we would do that twice before every pressing session or push session. GRIP tests were done before every single session, including pull. So we had at least two different measures of the bench press velocity testing to go off of each week. And we were able to analyze data and look at trends over time and compare it to high intensity and low intensity periods of the training block.
Okay, so let's dig a little bit around here. So what were you considering when you were deciding on hand grip?
Well, finding signs of central fatigue in from training especially, and it can be impacted by lots of other things as well. Getting sick, having, you know, high stress times in relationships or anything else, having a family member pass away. All those things can affect neural drive. So we were looking for overreaching trends that became pretty obvious. Like if you train really hard, your grip strength is lower soon after that in the next testing session. Were we able to create the correct trends to where he was peaking into competition neurally and physiologically to perform his best? Were we consistently overtraining? Were we training hard enough? So finding the monitoring means to do that with a special population was the biggest goal, and GRIP seemed to have one of the more established ways of doing that that wasn't biased towards the lower body.
How long did you do the study for?
Oh man, there were two separate training studies with this. We compiled the velocity data and GRIP training data over both of them, but one also measured the differences of using a strap on the bench like they do in para-powerlifting competition. They are secured to the bench, was like we said, most of the disabilities are lower body related. And I was looking at the stability aspect that changed velocities potentially. And we were trying to do that to make the measures more reliable, because if you are unstable, then your velocities are going to be all over the place to a large degree. I mean, that's pretty much what we found. But we did a 16-week study at first, and I believe the next one was 12 weeks.
All right. So long studies, in-depth observation of the athlete. Let's talk a little bit about the bench velocity. And imagine that the coach who is listening never measured velocity. They know nothing. Could you introduce the technique, what to pay attention to, what are pros and cons of this technique, of the measurement?
Yeah, well, the first thing to do with any monitoring method is to establish the standard way to do it. And we thought the easiest thing to do would just be to go with the closest adaptation to the rules of para-powerlifting itself. So we would unrack the weight, athlete would hold it. I would say start, give them their command, just like they would in competition. They would go down to the chest, pause. I would say press. And they would press, and then they would do the subsequent reps with a press command, but in a controlled fashion, following all the rules of competition. So we were able to make everything a lot more reliable with that, because it's not just, okay, do three reps where the first two happen real fast and they wait a second and do the last one. Everything was extremely regimented in that way. So we got really consistent numbers. So I think that's the biggest thing, because if you don't have reliable monitoring measures, your data is pretty much worthless. And it doesn't matter if it's velocity or grip training. We did everything the exact same way every single session, to the point of nausea. So, but with velocity measures, they're relatively simple. They make a lot of sense to the lay person, because if you can press the same weight faster than you did before, then you are stronger one way or another. You're creating more force or power in the same movement. And that's what we saw. So when you are more rested, that number should go up in velocity. And when you were more fatigued, you would expect it to go down. And those are the kind of things that we're able to see in the study. But we can also pull apart a lot of other things from that.
What things?
Oh, one of the most interesting things to me was, once we understood how the performance markers in the tests were supposed to go, after heavy training, the numbers would normally go down. After the lighter training and the early parts of the blocks, those performance numbers in the tests would go up, so that they were recovered and adapted to what they'd done before and ready for heavier training going forward. So we knew what the pattern was. When that pattern is no longer followed for some reason, we know something's up.
All right. So I think we're ready to listen a little bit about the athlete. As much as you can say.
The athlete had spina bifida. I can say that much. We were dealing with that specific deal. I don't know how much past that we can talk about. The athlete started at the beginning of the training process, I think at 190 something pounds, and they ended up dropping about 30 pounds to get into a lower weight class and finished at 163 pounds, I believe. So a 30 pound weight loss is really, really big when their body is primarily upper body. It's a much larger percentage.
Yes.
Than the able body person typically. We saw some interesting things with that, because the end result was around the same weight lifted, but formula wise, they were tremendously stronger. And part of the second study in the dissertation was actually the increased power output during that phase, because their range of motion, since they were losing weight, was increased by 4 centimeters. So they were moving more weight, or the same weight, farther at 30 pounds lighter body weight. That was a pretty cool result.
Well, wasn't the athlete preparing for some kind of competition?
Yes. We were taking them to the Endeavor Games. Was it Central Oklahoma? Yeah, University of Central Oklahoma. They have those games out there.
So it's like a national. I'm not familiar with the competition roster. So is it like a national level competition?
Yeah, the Endeavor Games is one of the largest para athletics events that we have in the country.
All right. Awesome. So lots of things going on. It's a case study, very close monitoring of one person, one athlete preparing for the competition. And you had all you can wish for in the study. You had a weight cut, sickness, and a normal preparation and peaking to the major competition. So you did two testing or monitoring methods, grip strength, bench press, velocity. With grip strength, you measured force.
Yeah. So we got a dynamometer and it measured specifically in kilograms how much force was created, peak force was created in the grip strength.
And with the bench press, did you go peak velocity or some other measures?
We took both, but the more reliable number seemed to be mean velocity, which is the case with static lifts. I know we look at peak velocity on a lot of weightlifting movements since they're a little bit more open chain. But with bench press, the mean velocity seemed to be more reliable. And I think that's especially the case with disabled athletes because stability is such a big issue. You can have all kinds of shifts and quick movements for compensation. And depending on, especially if you have your accelerometer or whatever you're using to measure velocity on one side or the other of the bar, if you're unstable, that means left or right side is going to be moving differently. The right side may have jumped up and the left side went nowhere. So having an accelerometer close to the center of the bar as possible is really big for getting quality measures there.
Are we ready for the results? What have you found?
Well, the biggest thing is we were able to find the trends of the training intensities and the response thereof, how the athlete covered and was looking to perform. We had several 4-week blocks where the first week was basically very light, and we saw an increase in those numbers throughout that week, the sharpest increase there was. And the second week was kind of a moderate intensity, and we still saw another big climb in the monitoring measures getting better. So he was getting more recovered during that second week. The third week was right around 90% intensity. If you look at a lot of research that's out there, when you start hitting around that 90% intensity, regardless of what the sport is or the training is, that's where it's kind of a line where fatigue starts to get accumulated instead of dissipating. So week 3, we stopped seeing that increase in measures, but he maintained pretty well. But he was also fresh going into that hard lifting. During the heaviest week, week 4 of that training block, we started seeing those measures crash after the really big, heaviest lifts that he was able to do and whatever rep ranges he was doing in that block. So we had an uptrend when the training was lighter, so he was able to recover a lot. And then, of course, after the heavier lifting, all those monitoring measures really just went in the basement. We were able to see that consistently, so we were able to predict and also adjust training volumes. And we figured out that he was able to recover from the lows we were giving him pretty well. And if he wasn't able to recover, we wouldn't have seen that consistent uptick in monitoring measures. So we basically had him dialed in where he specifically was able to handle the training very well repeatedly.
All right. Now, would you be able to see any differences related to the sickness? You mentioned a little bit that you had. Do you remember which week the sickness came with? Because you could see it coming.
Yeah, that was, I think he reported sick in the second or third week of the block we were in at that time. So we started to see the recovery from the first week. And then during the time he would normally be recovering farther, like halfway through the first week going into the second week, all of a sudden it started dropping. And it's, you know, seeing a big change like that sticks out like a sore thumb when you know what that pattern is supposed to be. And that's when, as a coach, especially if you have a sports scientist on board, you can see those numbers. Like sports scientist comes up to you, he's like, coach, we got something going on. Something's not right. And that's a big value of having data-driven coaching decisions.
Did you change anything or you just stayed vigilant and waited?
We didn't change anything when the measures were going down. We backed off a little bit because I was watching him very cautiously. And since everything is kind of relative intensity anyway, he's not at the 100% strength level that he normally would be anyway. Things start moving slower, so you reduce weight. So we adapted in that way. But when he actually became sick, he just had to be out for about a week. And then he came back, and those measures started at the bottom, and then they started eventually climbing back up and followed the same pattern after that once he was healthy.
Interesting. All right. Did you wanted to add anything about either athlete monitoring or this particular athlete? Any interesting findings or something unexpected, maybe?
Oh, one thing that was interesting that I'd learned, I kind of had an idea of it before, but I'd never seen data to really back it up. And that was the difference in recovery in the central nervous system fatigue and more peripheral total body fatigue. Because the bench press velocity is reliant both on the neural and on the actual tissue being recovered. So if the tissue is still sore or it's still damaged, the adaptations haven't occurred, you're not, those velocity numbers aren't going to increase at that point. Since the grip test was much more neural in nature, we actually saw the neural with the grip test recover back to 100% or his best levels of strength about 3 to 4 days before the bench press velocities did. So that gave us an insight into, okay, well, the nervous system seems to recover, you know, at least with this one athlete, considerably faster than the total body does. And we're able to look, okay, we might be able to infer or hypothesize that it's just the contractile tissue that is lagging behind in recovery and adaptation. And eventually it will catch up as well. So when we're tapering for competition, this actually becomes really important. This reflected what I've used with tons of athletes in different strength sports for 15 years at this point. By the time you are at the week of competition, weightlifting, strongman, powerlifting, whatever it might be, when you are tapering properly, at least in my experience, my opinion, and at least this case study backs that up. If you're competing on Saturday and you start feeling good or back to normal about Wednesday or Thursday, that seemed to reflect the time that you would be at your peak recovery neurally, as far as your central nervous system. There's still more to be done, but if you're feeling good around that point, then you're starting to itch. You know, you want to go lift and everything is super light right now and it's annoying, it's stupid, and you just want to go do the meet now and get it over with. You feel good.
No, true.
So yeah, like your anxiety starts ticking up, you just feel ready to go. And you still have 2-3 more days to wait, and it drives you nuts. That's a good thing, because that means your nervous system is ready to go, but the other physiological recovery processes still have a little bit more time that's needed. And that's a good sign that you timed your taper right. We were able to look at the tapering as well going into his competition in the first study. And that's basically what we saw. We had super heavy lifting 3 and 2 weeks out, and then we tapered in the competition. Basically, the last 10 days was all taper, and we watched all those measures tank as low as they'd ever been, and then a super sharp spike in all those measures. And we did testing on the day of the competition as well to get the final readings, and they were standard deviations higher than normal.
Ooh, that's what you want.
Yeah. And I'm sure it being competition day helped that as well. But you have to understand context there, because the athlete's nervous and their nervous system is going to be on overdrive too.
Awesome. That is a very useful thing to know, especially for coaches, but also for athletes, to know that you're feeling great 2-3 days before, but you're not ready. The body is not ready. You are ready. That's a good thing. Your nervous system is recovered, but there is more recovery to be done by tissues. So I find it very useful to know. So thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. I try to explain as many of those things as I can to my clients and athletes, because I understand what it feels like. You know, it's going into competition is some of the most stressful times that you can ever have. But if you can have an understanding of what the physiology is that goes into why you're feeling the way you are feeling at that time, and then it especially helps if I can predict what they're going to feel when they're going to feel it, and then it happens and they're like, yeah. Of course, it could all just be the power of suggestion too. That's when you get really good athlete buy-in for sure. And their confidence in you goes up, and then the programming. Everybody's happy. They perform better. They get strong. Do great things.
That's the idea. That's where we are heading towards.
Yeah.
Okay. Would you have any suggestions coming out of your study? This one we just discussed is very applicable to any athlete who is preparing for competition and all peaking in any sense. Understanding this process may save you some stupid endeavors 3 days before the competition only because you feel great. So that's very useful. Do you have any other suggestions that any strength athlete could use that come out of your study?
I think for one, I mean, it at least suggests that monitoring yourself can be extremely valuable. I did that myself because I was still competing in powerlifting at that time. And once I did that, I was really able to understand to a larger degree, like, sometimes I'm recovered, sometimes I'm not, because I understand variables that go into recovery, bad sleep, you know, relationship stress, all kinds of things like that. And some days you go into the gym and you feel okay, but the weights are moving slow. Everything feels heavy, but you didn't feel bad going in. And sometimes having some data to back up, like, something is off. I don't know what it is exactly, but it just seems to be off. You can give yourself a little bit of grace. And hopefully with some introspection or retrospection, either way, you can start to put puzzle pieces together. Maybe you're getting sick. Maybe other things are getting in the way, but that's just part of it. So at the very least, if you do some good monitoring measures, you can try, and a good way to say that, I guess, giving yourself grace is the best way to put that. Because sometimes there are things that are out of your control. We just don't know about. You don't know what you don't know. And we just have to get through it. Some days are good. Some days are bad. Most of them are okay. But having some data behind those things, especially the longer you can accumulate it over time, you start having a better understanding of how your body works, how long you need to recover. You can adjust training loads. You can do all kinds of stuff and see how it affects you. And then you can use those lessons and apply them for other people as well.
Okay. I have one more question that I thought of while we were talking. So considering grip strength measurement, you are, I guess, a fan of, because it worked for this athlete. Would you see it being implemented in weightlifters or powerlifters in full-bodied athletes?
Absolutely. Yeah, especially weightlifters. Everything competition lift-wise is almost, it has a potential choke point of the grip. So you can't produce more force into the bar than you can hold on to, or else you're just going to lose the bar. So I think that would be incredibly smart. And this was done, like I said, back in the Soviet Union with their weightlifting teams. But of course, you always have the examples and stories of weightlifters. If they wanted the day off, they wouldn't try too hard on that test. So they would be asked to sit. And I was like, oh no, but coach, I can really try. And no, your numbers are down. Go rest. I'm like, oh darn. Okay. Yeah, exactly.
All right. So you think it's susceptible to the effort the athlete is putting in, but otherwise you think it's a good measure?
Yeah, if everything lines up in the universe correctly, all monitoring measures can be super great data. But it's just one of those things, when you're working with real life people, you things change, and you just do the best that you can to get decent numbers.
All right, if the coach would be to implement velocity measures or on the static lifts or grip strength, in short, what do they have to take into account? It
standardization of the collection of the data with your monitoring test, super important. If you've got all kinds of variables that are changing from one test to the other, that's a big problem, because you don't know how to interpret those things properly. Even if the type of bench pad was changed, we were able to keep the same one the entire time, but if you go from a harder pad to a softer pad, that can impact velocities quite a bit, just because of the compressive effect and the stability. But so if you need good consistency in your tests, but also take notes, ask the athlete how they're doing. You know, surveys have been pretty valid for a long time. It's free, so you don't have to pay for anything. You just record their data, scale of 1 to 7. I forget the name of a lot of the surveys that we used in the past, but they're very handy. And I think they're a good tool, especially when you can have things like that combined with velocity measures and grip strength measures. Do they all line up? Because if you have one that's just off, like your velocity was down, but the grip was up, and the athlete says they're good, you've got 2 out of 3 monitoring tests that says they're doing pretty good. That could just be an anomaly. You never know what happened. But if you have all 3 of those measures inputs recommending that the athlete is feeling great or feeling terrible, either way, you have a little bit more confidence that if you see that backed up by their body language and how they're performing, then yeah, you need to make decisions based off that. But having good, reliable data is just a helping hand to the coach. The coach's eye is always going to be the end decision, for sure. And I think a lot of people in sports science get that mixed up, because everything that we learned in physiology class and kinesiology class and nutrition class and all those different things, it's about 10% of coaching. 90% is gaining experience and working with people. And that's an art, 100% an art. So we get more tools in our tool bag, and sometimes we spend too much time in the lab and not actually training or competing in things, then we start to lose perspective on that. We start majoring in the mind and worrying about, you know, the minute details of the power stroke and the actin and the myosin contracting and pulling the sarcomere and generating force like that, when at the end of the day, you should probably just talk to your athlete, see how they're doing that day.
True. Very important points. All right, let's finish with some summary. So what would be your 3 lessons for coaches and athletes in strength sports to apply from the study?
Well, especially for disabled athletes, we need monitoring to make sure that they stay safe and to preserve their quality of life. It's also an amazing tool for giving them advantages in competition, so they can train at a higher level, higher performance, all those things. It's great. But I think it's drastically more important that we preserve their quality of life and make sure that they are not incapacitated and not able to live their lives, because there's such a sharp decline if they get an injury. Definitely number one on my priority list with this study. The second one, I would really love for somebody to replicate the study. Hopefully there will be opportunity to do that in the future. future. I continue to work with disabled athletes now when I can. I've done consulting for Team USA Parapowerlifting. I have some things coming up with the U.S. Army as well, with the like Wounded Warriors and different that run competitions and things like that in a consulting role. So I'm hoping that we'll be able to further this kind of study. And, you know, mine is almost a shot in the dark. We have one subject, but of course you're not going to have like a pharmaceutical study where you have 10,000 samples and or people to study. It's like the population is so low, but it's so important to have done for the quality of life of these people and these athletes. And I really hope somebody will replicate that. I know that's not much of a tip, but I think it's really important to get out there. And the third tip would be to use monitoring methods to hopefully get ahead of sickness, since we had a really good example of that in this case study. If you have those numbers, when you're seeing a decline where there's not supposed to be a decline especially, then usually 2 or 3 days of that kind of trend popping up out of nowhere, you're almost certain that there's something else going on and you need to back off and hopefully minimize the damage of whatever sickness is coming on. That'll also, on top of helping your athlete not be down as long, it'll make you look incredibly smart in the eyes of your athlete and the administration. Like, oh, you're getting sick. Just wait a couple of days. It's going to show up. And then bam, they've got a sinus infection. And, oh, okay. Well, I guess you know what you're talking about.
True. I think this study is very applicable to any athlete, especially in strength sports, because we are so familiar to monitoring lower body performance. But having, well, for athletes who have knee injury or hip injury or whatever, they can't perform jumping or pulling necessary. So having another measure added probably earlier than the injury happened, or if the recovery is very long, you have time to actually implement it from scratch to have something to monitor the athlete and seeing what's going on a daily basis, replacing the lower body measurements. I think that this is great to know that this is a possibility to test.
Definitely. And I think it gives you a much more individualized approach for every athlete that you are able to work with, because every athlete's going to respond differently to a large degree of training. And granted, good training should work to a large degree for most people, but it's going to work differently. It's just like medication. Some people respond well to medication. Some people it doesn't work as well. Some people are allergic. So I think we have to take the same kind of approach with training recommendations as well. And monitoring gives us the tools to do that, gives us the information to make better informed decisions to help our athletes be first safe and then perform at their best. My encouragement to everyone listening, if you're in a position to do so, you'll work with some of these disabled athletes. One, it's great for them. It's great for quality of life. You'll develop some amazing relationships. I know I did. Some of the people that I cherish the most came from doing this kind of work. So do that and somebody replicate this study and see how much of it will apply more universally. We need a lot bigger sample size figuring out, is this a single case scenario with, you know, the recovery and performance trends that we saw in the data? How much does it vary? How do we individualize with the different disabilities? All the things like that. There's so much more to do. And I really look forward to hopefully seeing it.
Awesome. Last two questions to finish. The first one is, what is your favorite lift?
Oh, my favorite lift would be deadlift. I'm not the best at it. All my records that I broke were in the squat, but to me, the deadlift is the simplest yet most complicated lift that we do, because it's simple in nature and the execution of it. But between the ears, I think it's the toughest, because you have to figure out how to put 100% effort on something that may not move in the least for 100, you know, a maximal deadlift, but you have to figure out how to give your greatest effort to do that, whether it's going to go or it's not. So it's very difficult mentally.
Right. Super heavy too. So awesome. And the last question is, if people want to contact you or keep up to date with your work, where they can find you online?
Most active on Instagram at Wilcox Strength Inc. And I'm also on Facebook. I've got Wilcox Strength Inc. Facebook page and also my personal page on there as well. I'm on rpstrength.com. I've been a coach with them for a decade now, doing lots of work in the private sector. And it's hopefully going to facilitate more kinds of research like this for disabled athletes and hopefully kids. I really love working with kids a lot. And one of my long-term goals is to have a training system developed to where the parents can go to the gym, because that's usually one of the biggest excuses I get with people, like, oh, I've got kids at home. I can't get away to go to the gym. I really want to start facilities where child care and child development physically, like a PE program, is a super high priority. So everybody can go get fit. The kids go do their thing. They're taken care of and they're developing great. And parents can focus on their own goals too.
This is such an amazing idea. Wishing you all the best. Thank you so much for today and see you next time.
pleasure. Thank you.